Good morning. Like you, I still have memories from high school. And like at least some of you, not all of these memories are embarrassing. I remember one teacher in particular, a Talmud teacher, and we were studying a passage of Tosafot, the 12th to 13th century scholars from northern France and Germany, whose analyses are now printed on the outside border of the standard Talmud page. I don't remember what question he was asked, but I do remember his answer. His answer was, Tosafot could not imagine that Jews like us would exist. And that line has always stuck with me. It's pithy, it's funny, and it conveys a certain truth, because in fact, Tosafot could not imagine that Jews like us would exist. Tosafot could not have imagined that Jews like us would live in a free society. They couldn't have imagined a free society. Tosafot could not have imagined that Jews would live in a society in which Judaism was cool. They couldn't have imagined, of course, cool. Tosafot could not have imagined that Jews would live in a society in which Christians would respect and value Judaism and Jewish rituals. They could never have imagined, for example, that there would be churches that would want to celebrate Passover Seders. And more to the point of our talk this morning, Tosafot could never have imagined that the modest Talmudic phrase Tikkun Olam would undergo a profound transformation in the 20th century to become the shorthand for a relatively newly discovered Jewish religious obligation to fix and repair our broken world. Tosafot could not have imagined that. They certainly could not have imagined that a man like the Christian philosopher and activist Cornel West would embrace the phrase Tikkun Olam and even proclaim on more than one occasion Tikkun Olam all the way. Tosafot certainly could not have imagined these things. They could not have imagined what we think of as a cause, whether the cause be climate change or other environmental issues, or creating equality of opportunity or equality of education for children across the globe. They wouldn't have thought in those terms. To Tosafot and to the other Jewish scholars, legal scholars of the Middle Ages, the cluster of concerns that we group under the heading social responsibility were actually grouped under a number of smaller headings. There was tzedakah, charity, and the laws of tzedakah. There was gemilut chasadim, a Hebrew phrase meaning reciprocation of kindness or acts of kindness. There were laws governing how to relate to tenants, how to relate to workers, how to engage ethically in business with one another, how to engage ethically with ourselves on other occasions as well. All of these were under discrete headings. Again, these various concerns that today we group under the heading social responsibility, Tosafot and their fellow Jewish legal scholars of the Middle Ages would have grouped under these different headings. So we have, broadly speaking, two large models. We have what we might think of as a medieval model of social responsibility, which is essentially the responsibility that one Jew had to another, a responsibility that was carried out and discharged largely, although not entirely, on a localized basis within discrete Jewish communities. And then we have social responsibility, which is appropriate to our world being a global village that Tosafot also could not have imagined. And it's a social responsibility that I'll call the social responsibility of the global village. We have these two models, each historically appropriate to its own time, each a product of its own time. Now, I'm not going to engage in some fruitless line of inquiry as to which is better, and oh, we should jettison our our social responsibility of the global village for the medieval model or try to argue along those lines. But what I do want to point out is that there are some unintended consequences of the social responsibility of the global village, some unintended consequences, perhaps unforeseen consequences, and we want to look to Jewish tradition to find ways to deal with those unintended consequences. And I'd like to illustrate those unintended consequences by talking about portraits of two types of Jews. The first type of Jew was one that I met a few years back. I was speaking to a woman who described her husband as the best Jew that she knows, a very happy, warm sentiment. And then she went on, and he's a Catholic. He's the best Jew I know, and he's a Catholic, Well, at this point, of course, I'm very intrigued. What is her definition of what is a Jew, let alone what is her definition of what is the best Jew that she knows? And she went on to explain that her husband is very deeply and passionately engaged in human rights work, in social justice work, and this, in her view, made her husband the best Jew that she knows. Now, there's some good news in that. The good news is that among right-thinking people, we Jews have a good reputation. We stand for the right things. On the other hand, there's some disquieting news in that. That's a rather thin definition of what it means to be a Jew and of what Judaism is. And I was recently thinking again about my conversation with that woman as I was reading a book that was just published by the Catholic religious writer Joseph Bottom. The book is called An Anxious Age. And toward the beginning of the book, Bottom writes about a phenomenon that he calls thinning up, how the rich, robust Protestant Christian culture of an earlier generation became thinned up in a subsequent generation. The later generation retains some of the cultural patterns of the earlier generation, some of the same values, some of the same concerns, but over time, the robust Protestant Christian frame in which all that was held fell away. It was thinned up. The Protestant culture of the earlier age was thinned up into something else. And I was thinking that what this lady represents is really a thinning up of Judaism, a thinning up of Judaism into social responsibility. Social responsibility is key. It is a mitzvah. It is a divine imperative. But it's disquieting to think of the rich, robust Jewish religious culture being thinned up this way into social responsibility. Well, then how do we deal with this? What do we say? How do we thicken up these thinned up Jews? How do we thicken them up? Well, one thing we could do is we could take them all for dinner at my mother's house. That would be very effective in the short run. I don't think it would be very effective in the long run, but it would help in the short run. But there are more substantive things we can do. One of them is we can stress the priority of study. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, I thought we were talking about social responsibility. Why are we talking about study? We're talking about study because study is the indispensable basis of everything that happens in Judaism. It is through study that we immerse ourselves in the language and culture of Torah, in the vocabulary of Judaism as it has historically developed. It is through study that we really know the rituals and beliefs and practices of Judaism. Study means engagement with the full range of genres of Jewish writing, from the Bible to the Talmud, the mystical tradition, to cultural genres that may not necessarily have a religious component, such as novels and poetry. Study means being willing to engage with texts and traditions that will challenge your preconceptions. Study means that you're willing to expose yourself to the multivocality, the many voices of the tradition, and that you'll be open and willing, if need be, to change your mind. Study should be contrasted very sharply with proof texting. Study is not proof texting, and proof texting is not study. Proof texting is taking a verse, a Talmudic passage, a Hasidic story, or what have you, and using it to support a position you already hold. At the extreme, proof texting can be used to squeeze Judaism into the Procrustean bed of a particular ideological perspective. That is not what study is. Study, properly pursued, is a way that we can help to thicken ourselves up from this thinned up sort of Judaism. A second way is to invite our thinned up Jews, which is all of us, I think, at one time or another, but to invite us to think deeply about the term and concept of mitzvah. Mitzvah, of course, means commandment. Colloquially, it's undergone a very interesting transformation of its own. It can mean good deed or whatever seems like a nice thing to do. It may interest you to know that in the 3rd to 5th centuries in the land of Israel, the rabbis of the land of Israel used the word mitzvah as a synonym for charity. It meant charity. And it wasn't only the rabbis, by the way. Their contemporaneous Christian neighbors also used a Semitic cognate word for mitzvah that meant charity. And we see this in the rabbinic literature of the land of Israel. The poor will say, give me a mitzvah, meaning give me charity. People will be described as the mare mitzvata, the master of the mitzvot, meaning a baal chesed, a master of charity. It's almost as if the rabbis wanted to say, or the rabbis that used the term wanted to say, that charity was the mitzvah, the quintessential mitzvah. But what's interesting and important to note is that ultimately the word tzedakah predominated as the term for charity. The rabbis were well aware that mitzvah covers a full range of Jewish rituals, Shabbat, holidays, kashrut, the entire range of Jewish practices. The rabbis, as it were, then put charity in its place. It is a major mitzvah, a significant mitzvah. There are hundreds and hundreds of rabbinic traditions that extol the spiritual power of tzedakah, but it is a mitzvah among the mitzvot. The notion that it is the quintessential mitzvah does not stand, does not survive the passage of time. In fact, the later Babylonian Talmud, a product of the 7th century, doesn't know of mitzvah as a word for charity. Tzedakah is the term for charity in the Babylonian Talmud. The rabbis signal this tendency to view charity and what we might think of as social responsibility as a mitzvah among the mitzvot in another way. The rule is, on Shabbat, one is not permitted to discuss business. I hope that was followed during the joint board meeting. I know the there might be a temptation to discuss business on Shabbat, but the rule is one must not discuss business on Shabbat. There is an exception, however, when it comes to charity. On Shabbat, we are permitted to discuss how much charity we will give after Shabbat. The exception doesn't go that far. We're not allowed to touch money on Shabbat, and there's no exception for charity. We're not allowed to put our hand in our pocket on Shabbat to pull out the money to give as charity. Again, charity is significant. It's holy. It's a divine imperative. It rates an exception when it comes to being able to speak about monetary matters, but it does not rate an exception that allows it to trump the observance of Shabbat, which ranks extremely high in Jewish tradition. So thus far, we have two ways we can think of to thicken ourselves up, to thicken up this thinned up Judaism, to think of social responsibility as a thread, a scarlet thread, a very important thread in a larger tapestry, which is Judaism. Then there's the second type of Jew, which is me, which I suspect is some of you and the people that will be watching this. This is the Jew who says, I have a good strong moral compass. And they're right, by the way. I have a good moral compass. I'm an ethical person. I have excellent principles. What I believe just has to be what Judaism teaches. I mean, I'm a good ethical person. What I believe just has to be what Judaism believes. This is the Jew that I call the projection Jew, the Jew who projects her own very strong moral and ethical compass onto Judaism. At an extreme, you can get a situation where a Jew may say, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a socialist, now's the time for socialism, I'm a libertarian, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative. These are all good principles. We all want to do the right thing by society. We all have the right ideas. I'm surrounded by good people. My ideology must be what Judaism teaches. And in fact, Jews are Democrats, Republicans, socialists, libertarians, liberals, and conservatives, but Judaism is not. Judaism is apolitical. Judaism should be apoliticized. Judaism does not teach us to vote for this or that candidate, to support this or that piece of legislation. That does not mean that the use of Jewish texts and traditions has no place in these conversations. But when we think back to what we said about study a few moments ago, the use of Jewish texts and traditions has to be conducted with an eye to looking at the full range of what Jewish tradition has to say about an issue. Jewish tradition, the Talmudic legal tradition, is about discussion. It's about argument. It doesn't have to be friendly discussion. It wasn't always. But it's about discussion, argument, debate. It's about making one's case reasonably, using reason and attempting to persuade others of the rightness of one's views based on the reading of texts. This is how we should be relating to each other, not by saying, I'm with this party and it represents what is right. You are with that party or that tendency or that perspective, and that represents what is wrong. I'd like to illustrate a little more about this point, about the apolitical nature of Judaism, by bringing in one of my favorite characters, a rabbi from 16th century Poland, Lublin, named Rabbi Shlomo Luria. I always say to the students, I'm in absolutely no hurry to get to the next world, but when I get there, he's one of the people I would like to meet. Luria writes in one of his responsa, a learned response to a question, an issue that was presented to him, that he was approached privately by some people to advocate for a widow in the city of Lublin. This lady was a widow who was being taken advantage of financially by a man in the town. The details don't need to concern us now. And Luria initially represents himself as hesitating about getting involved. He said, well, there already is a judge on the case. It's not that nobody in Lublin knows about this. There's a judge appointed. There's a court that's going to be sitting to hear this issue. He says, you know, if I get involved, it might offend that judge. He might think, Luria doesn't think I'm going to do the right thing by this woman. Ultimately, Luria decides he has to get involved. And you may remember the quote by the great sage and leader Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. Luria essentially says something that comes out more or less to, with great learning comes great responsibility. Luria says, well, when we go back to the Torah, we see that there's a covenant for the widow and the orphan. God represents God's self as being particularly interested in what happens in society to the widow and the orphan. And Luria says it is incumbent upon, it is an obligation of anybody who has knowledge of Jewish law, who has knowledge of the Torah, and who is able to use that knowledge to rescue the vulnerable from someone who would prey upon them, it's incumbent upon that person to do that. So he says, notwithstanding my concerns about the little political difficulties I might get myself into here in Lublin, I'm going to get involved. What did Luria do? Well, in our terms, he represented truth to power. He placed his responsibility to act for the vulnerable above his party, as it were. Luria and this judge, they're on the same side. They're part of the same group of the learned elite of Lublin. He was willing to risk alienating someone from his own siyah, his own party, in order to stand up and do individually what he thought was right. This is true heroism. Well, if we look so far at what we've discussed in order study, mitzvah, apolitical or apoliticized, and then heroism. If we move these letters around a bit, we come up with the transliteration of Shema. Study, heroism, mitzvah, apolitical. Shema, of course, we know. It's Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. It's the fundamental statement of our belief in God's unity. For our purposes today, maybe we can think of it as well in a different way, a shorthand for a fundamental unity in Judaism, a unity in which all the mitzvot have importance, in which all the texts, all the traditions have importance. Again, not that every ritual is recoverable, not that every text is uplifting, but that everything deserves our attention. Social responsibility is a powerful mitzvah, a divine, holy imperative. But again, it is one thread in a larger tapestry, which is Judaism. This is something that Tosafot could have imagined, a Judaism in which the mitzvot are all there, side by side, a unified Judaism in which all mitzvot, all texts, all practices are equally deserving of our attention. This is something they could have imagined and that they practiced, and it is something that we can imagine and we can practice as well. Not Judaism as a window dressing for ideas and beliefs and preconceptions that we bring to it, but Judaism as the foundation from which our own dedication to social responsibility, among other things, can flow. Shema. Thank you.